Use of wagon hounds was one of the oldest methods of transporting hidden liquor around the Indian Territory. They did this by fastening tin containers of whiskey to the hounds, where they could ride inconspicuously under the wagon. The zinc vest was another novel device for carrying fire water in the Indian Territory. It was constructed like an ordinary vest worn by any man, except that it was worn under other clothing. The zinc vest usually held about 2 gallons of whiskey. It was hollow, of course, and it narrowed to feather edges at the sides. The main part of the bulge was fitted up under the armpits. The length came down to the waistband of a man's pants. It had a hole at the top with a tight-fitting screw cap, where, to use the bootlegger's term, they loaded the animal. At the bottom in front was a small opening with a stopcock or faucet. A bootlegger would walk around at a picnic or camp meeting, looking prosperous and wise. If a fellow wanted to drink, he and the customer would go behind a wagon, bush, or tree. But before long, the deputies would get wise to this trick, too, and they'd have to come up with a new scheme. An old painter in Ada used to carry around a couple of paint buckets that caused no suspicion. Then one day, Bob Hutchins began to look around for some places he had painted and couldn't find any. So the next morning, Hutchins inspected the buckets and invoiced quite a bit of whiskey, but no paint. The painter was sentenced to 30 days in jail and $50 fine. When he got out of jail, the poor fella stuck an old rusty nail in his foot, so he said he had to go around on crutches. His leg swelled to an enormous size and looked as if it might have to be amputated. That same unfeeling Deputy Marshal Hutchins, who had ruined his paint business, met him on the street, hauled out his six-shooter, and whacked his swollen leg a hard blow. Liquid flowed through the bandage, but it wasn't quite red and thick enough for blood, and it certainly didn't smell like blood. Hutchins didn't arrest him again. He was punished enough by losing his booze, but the boys fairly hooted him out of town. In 1915, Bob Hutchins threw his hat into the political ring for Chief of Police of Ardmore. Many looked upon his act with dismay and were sure he had committed political suicide because he filed on the Republican ticket. He had dared do this in an election in southern Oklahoma, even then so thoroughly Democratic it was called Little Dixie. Talk went around in Ardmore that Bob Hutchins didn't have a ghost of a chance to become the chief. And this talk persisted even on the day of the general election, April the 30th, 1915. But the forward-looking people, who wanted to be certain that Ardmore would be rid of many of its nefarious vices, remembered Hutchins' reputation as the nemesis of bootleggers and as a fearless, honest, and hard-riding officer who had already come up against all classes of criminals. These good citizens kept their mouths shut and voiced their sentiments on the ballots. Hutchins was given a popular vote at the polls that left no doubt in anybody's mind they had discarded politics to vote for a man of action. When Bob Hutchins took office as Chief of Police in Ardmore, Oklahoma, his first official act was a secret one in which he appointed 2 men as anonymous policemen. They never wore badges and they never made a single arrest, but they probably caused more arrests than any known man on the force. They didn't appear on the regular police payroll. They went about their usual occupations around town, but their eyes and ears were open, and they reported privately every bit of information they thought Hutchins should know about the vice rackets and other violations of the law. One was H.G. Stong, a cabinet builder, and such a good one that he was in demand most of the time. When a bootlegger or dope pusher employed him to build a secret cabinet or wall safe, Stong made drawings of the construction and its location and turned it over to Chief Hutchins. When it was time to make a raid on one of these locations, Chief Hutchins sent a couple of his policemen, or more when necessary. Of course, it was an easy task for him, but to his policemen it seemed uncanny. The men were paid out of funds of his expense account, which he explained to the commissioners as endeavoring expenses. When Bob Hutchins became Chief of Police in Ardmore in 1915, Caddo Street was a roaring line still craving human blood day and night as men's tempers exploded in dispute, grudge, or vengeance. In the Indian Territory days, it became known nationally as Notorious Bloody Caddo, one of the toughest streets in the entire world. That was about the time that Captain Maggie Hobbs of the Salvation Army came to Ardmore and found her way into the hearts of thousands of Ardmoreites and dedicated her life to the cause of God and humanity. With his eyes moist with memories that faded the steel glint in them, Bob Hutchins told his biographer, "I've seen the time when Captain Maggie stood on one quarter of Bloody Caddo and Broadway with a Bible in her hands and religion in her heart, and I stood on the opposite corner with my old six-shooter in my hand and a firm determination in my mind. What Maggie and I did to that Caddo bunch of renegades was a miracle." Bob Hutchins, Ardmore's chief of police, had demanded that the leaking tank car be removed from the city limits. But before anything could be done, at 2:27 p.m., September the 27th, 1915, the tank car exploded. The police station shook and vibrated, windows crashed, and the ground quaked. In the twinkling of an eye, the eastern half of the Ardmore business district had been completely destroyed. Not many window panes were left unsmashed in Ardmore and for miles away. There were many flimsy wooden buildings in Ardmore at that time. Most all of these from Washington Street down East Main Street and across the railroad track were flattened or burning. Never before in the petroleum industry history had there been such a tragedy. The blast in Ardmore was counted as one of the greatest explosions in history. Bloody Caddo Street, for a couple of blocks both north and south off Main Street, was a holocaust of fire. The Santa Fe paid out millions of dollars in claims, ranging from just a few dollars to many thousands, for both lives and property, without a single lawsuit. From an article dated September 1917 and reprinted in the Bicentennial edition of the Ardmoreite dated July the 4th, 1976. Ardmore's development in the last year, 1916 and 17, is little short of marvelous. Reaching back farther, the census of 1910 shows that Ardmore had a population of 9,686. And in that year, there were just 12 automobiles within the city of Ardmore, with more than 2,000 within the city today. The bank deposits show a remarkable increase. In June of 1917, the total was close to $5 million. The most marked improvement is construction of the Simpson Building, a six-story office and bank structure which is now being completed. The cost of the building will reach more than $200,000. The new Ardmore Hotel is in the process of construction. It's to be an eight-story, $250,000 structure built upon thoroughly modern lines. This is from the Bicentennial edition of the Daily Ardmoreite, dated July the 4th, 1976. Oil made Ardmore. One of the men who helped in that making was Walter H. Gant. When I saw my first oil well, it did something to me. It was flowing so easy, with no effort on the part of man. It looked like the easiest money I ever saw. Someone called it black gold, and I thought that was a pretty good statement. I've never gotten over it, Gant said. Gant related the story of Roy Johnson and Captain Cook, an inebriated hanger-on who happened to have a genius for oil, accidentally discovered the oil pool that became known as the Heelton Field by looking for asphalt beds. The dead oil sand was, according to Gant, rabbit tracks for an oil pool, and the rich Heelton Field was founded on that basis. He ended the interview with his perpetual advice, to hang on to your land. Bill Skelly came to the area walking in front of two mules hitched to a wagon loaded with a string of cable tools. When asked why he was walking in front of the wagon, Skelly replied, "To keep my creditors away." Evidently, he didn't have that problem long. The late philanthropist bought a 20-acre lease in the Heelton Field, which made him all his original money, according to an interview from the Bicentennial edition of the Ardmoreite, dated July the 4th, 1976, with Walter Gant. He also told about meeting Frank Phillips at the Ardmore Hotel. "He seemed to be pleased to visit with me there at the hotel. I was pleased, a greenhorn, visiting with a greater man like that," said Gant, who at the time daringly approached the oil tycoon with a deal. Before leaving on the train, Skelly said, "I'll take the lease you told me about." Gant drew up the lease and started contracting for the drilling. I brought in a 20-million-foot gasser for Phillips, and he paid every check I wrote on him for the deal. We became friends for life. Ardmore's association with oil extends back into Indian Territory days after its founding in 1887, when the Santa Fe Railroad built through the territory near Healton, about 25 miles west of Ardmore, in the Red Beds country. A man named Palmer drilled near some oil seeps with a hand-powered spring pole drilling rig. At about 400 feet, oil filled the hole and flowed slowly over the rim. Palmer failed to interest capital in his discovery and subsequently disappeared from the scene. The immediate result was that farmers in the area had a source of lubrication for their wagon and buggy axles, and the spirit of the oil patch settled in Ardmore. In 1912, Roy Johnson decided to try for oil in the area of the Old Palmer Well, and in August 1913, they brought in the discovery well of the fabulous Healton Field. The spirit of oil that had brooded for so long in Ardmore gushed from the wells that were immediately drilled by the hundreds and finally by the thousands in Carter County and adjacent areas. The Healton Field was discovered and first developed by Independents, and they soon found that they had to fight for what was theirs, and they could fight more effectively by joining forces. The new field was not yet a year old when in 1914 the Independents, under the leadership of Wirt Franklin and other local leaders, formed the Ardmore Independent Oil Producers Association. Their troubles and their goals had to do with conservation, pipeline runs, and the price of oil. The new groups of Independents went to work with state and federal governments for fair play for Independents. The federal government was involved primarily because there were restricted Indian lands in the Healton Field. In 1929, the Independent Petroleum Association of America was formed during a government-called conference. In the forefront of the new organization were the Ardmore Independents. Wirt Franklin was its president, assisted by many of the local oil people, all of whom had participated in the various efforts to solve the problem of the independent producer. These included Max Westheimer, Ed Galt, Fred Tucker, Sam Dobby, Will Smith, Walter Neustadt, Frank and Ward Merrick, and many others who have contributed so much to the oil industry in Oklahoma. Many stories have been told by the old-timers of the exploits of Buck Garrett, sheriff of Carter County, from 1911 to 1922, and Bud Belew, his chief deputy. Buck was beloved by his men, by the citizens, and even by the outlaws whom he apprehended and battled. The outlaws whom he opposed admired Buck as the man's man. Many of them exchanged shots with him and did their best to get him. But instead of cursing him and threatening him when they were evading his authority, or even after they were confined in jail, they always spoke of Buck in the highest terms of respect and admiration. Buck's closest friend was Bud Belew, one of his deputies. It appears that the magnetic influence which makes a great feeling of friendship spring up between some men when they get acquainted with each other occurred in the case of Buck and Bud. Buck stated that there were but two things he had against Bud. They were the facts that Bud won't smoke cigarettes or go to a movie show. Otherwise, said Buck, he's okay. One time, Bud Belew happened to be in Wirt, an oil field town formerly known as Ragtown. He passed a restaurant, and glancing in, he noticed that there was an unusual commotion. He entered and found that a bandit, masked with a handkerchief over his face, holding several people at bay with two revolvers. The outlaw had spied Bud upon the latter's entry and shot him in the stomach before Bud had taken his bearing. Although wounded, Bud pulled his revolver and killed the bandit. Fortunately, Bud's wound was slight, and he soon recovered. Identification of the dead man disclosed that he was an outlaw named Pete Bynum, who was playing tough in the oil fields. In connection with this episode was the killing of an innocent boy who was in the shack next door at the time of the shooting. One of the bullets fired during the duel between Bud and the outlaw went through the wall and killed the young man, who was being shown the sights of an oil town by a friend who worked in the fields. The town of Wirt was the first oil town in southern Oklahoma. At the time of many of the disorders and gunplay, it was known as Ragtown. It was known throughout the entire Southwest as the most lawless community in the country, where gambling, drinking, and other immoral and illegal activities, today viewed only in the movies and on TV, held sway. There were shootings galore, and the sheriff's office was kept busy. Bud Ballou had to contend with many outlaws who refused to be taken alive, and as a result, he was forced to kill them or be killed himself. One such character was a gunman who made it his business to violate the law. He was a high-strung and nervous person and always seemed to be in some kind of trouble. He took great pride in his shooting ability and seemed always to force his way with a gun. Bud was sent to arrest him and during the latter's outbreaks was forced to kill him during the exchange of shots.